welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast. The podcast focuses on the importance that culture plays in all areas of business and society, from how it shapes organizations and work to how it influences consumer experience, innovation, design, and larger societal trends. My name is John Curran, and I'm your host. I'm a business anthropologist, executive coach, systemic team coach, facilitator, and trainer. I'm also the CEO of JC & Associates, which is a consultancy that helps businesses develop better working cultures and relationships with all their stakeholders. I have been working as a business anthropologist for over 20 years now. By business anthropologist, I mean that I use my anthropological training to advise businesses on how to improve their organizational cultures, or think about how they connect with their consumers, or begin to design future strategies that take into account the most complex and often messy concept that they are constantly faced with. This is culture. There's no doubt that once leaders or teams embrace the subtle ways in which culture works, they can feel liberated and empowered to move forward in positive ways. However, selling in an anthropological approach can, at times, be a challenge. This is mainly because companies often need quick fixes or want to see the value before they have addressed any business challenge. As I said, culture is messy, and therefore it takes time to unravel. One needs to see in between the lines and identify the grey spaces of everyday culture. This is a key strength of social or cultural anthropology in business. So, how do we make sense of culture and society? And how do we communicate the massive value that an anthropological approach can offer business, politics, policymakers, and more? To help me explore this, I spoke with Gillian Tett about her new book, Anthrovision: How Anthropology Can Explain Business and Life. Gillian is the chair of the editorial board and editor-at-large at the Financial Times. She is perhaps best known for predicting the 2007-08 financial crisis. This led to her best-selling book, Fool's Gold, which was one of the definitive books on the crash. Like me, Gillian holds a PhD in social anthropology. She studied at the University of Cambridge, where her PhD focused on marriage rituals in Tajikistan. Her work for the Financial Times has taken her around the world, and she has won numerous awards, including Columnist, Journalist, and Business Journalist of the Year at the British Press Awards. She is also a regular at Davos. Although Anthrovision has just been published, it has already gained much acclaimed attention in the global media and business press. She has already discussed the book on BBC Radio 4 Start the Week, alongside the psychologist Daniel Kahneman. While Melinda Gates states that anyone working to rebuild a more equal world will benefit from Tett's well-argued case that to solve 21st century problems, we must expand our fields of vision and fill in old blind spots with new empathy. All relevant links to this, of course, will be in the show notes. I start by asking Gillian why she felt the need to write Anthrovision. I hope you enjoy. But I'm just going to really start, Gillian, by kind of saying, you know, that kind of general question about what led you to write Anthrovision, and why is it important today?
Well, what led me to write it, and it has been in years in the making, was that I've often been asked in my career as a journalist covering finance and economics and politics and business, why on earth I have such a, quote, weird background. And, you know, although I've been working in the areas of sort of high finance and politics and business for years, people tend to assume that I've got a PhD in economics or an MBA or something like that. I've actually got a PhD in cultural anthropology. I did my fieldwork in a place called Soviet Tajikistan, just north of Afghanistan, looking at marriage rituals as a tool to look at Islamic and communist Soviet identity. And that's not an obvious path to take you into looking at, say, derivatives or the political system in America or anything like that. But I happen to believe it's incredibly useful. It's shaped the way I've looked at the world. And I wrote the book to explain why anybody in whatever field they're in, law, medicine, business, the military, policymaking, anything like that, can really benefit from anthropology.
But The interesting point is it's kind of the, it feels like the book's landed at the right time, right? In where we are in the world. I'm just kind of thinking, where does it feel for you? I mean, this book could have been written 10 years ago and would have been totally relevant, but I'm just thinking, is there something really important about it kind of being present now?
Well, I happen to believe that it actually is a fantastic moment to be thinking about cultural analysis, really for three key reasons. Firstly, it's become very clear in the last decade, really since 2008, that many of the intellectual tools we use to try and navigate the world with, like big data sets, like economic models, like corporate balance sheets, are really useful in some situations, but they are not sufficient in all situations, and they can actually mislead you. And it's very simple that most of these tools are defined by the inputs, the boundaries of the model or the balance sheet or big data set, which is fine if the context around them is not changing. But if the context is changing rapidly, then the tools can mislead. I mean, the image I use is a bit like someone walking through a dark wood at night with a compass. If you just look at the compass all the time, look down the dial, you're going to trip over a tree root. So what I'm arguing is we shouldn't toss these tools out at all. They're useful. You don't want to throw out your compass in the wood. But we need to use them with a sense of context and consequences and culture, because culture shapes how we develop and interpret those tools. And it's particularly important to think about culture right now because of two other reasons. Firstly, lockdown has given us all a culture shock of sorts because we've all been forced to take a new look at practices and ideas that we used to take for granted. And then secondly, the dash into digital is creating a whole new set of cultural challenges all over again that we urgently need to think about, particularly in a world where, in fact, we're not all identical. Cultures don't exist in boxes. They're a spectrum. But there's a spectrum of difference, and we need to recognise that difference and recognise that cultures change and think quite consciously and actively what it means to be human in a digital age.
I think that's a good point. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about, I was trying to, you know, think about being a leader or on a board and stuff, and I kind of throwing this question, kind of, well, what's wrong with our Western models of how we do stuff? And you know, it's all rational. And what I really like this idea of the compass. And I read it, I've heard you talk about it, but it just stuck with me a bit. And often when I'm working with boards and executives, I talk about the blinkered vision or that they're institutionalized. And it sounds very kind of unproductive or they're not being active. But actually using a compass is quite a rational action. It goes from A to B, and it's a technology that gives you fact. It's almost the ultimate piece of rationality. But it's not enough.
Well, I mean, the American political system was founded on the concept of checks and balances, and most people think checks and balances are a good thing. And I think what anthropology gives is a chance to create a sense of check and balance for your compass. And I can't stress strongly enough, I'm not saying you need to throw out your economic model, big data set, corporate balance sheet, because they're useful. But you need to have checks and balances and realize how the context around them can change. And it's, you know, very easy to dismiss that or ignore it if we're busy or under pressure to be efficient or streamlined, or more importantly, if you've been successful in the past. But if you do ignore it, then you can end up facing problems. And to give a tiny concrete example of this, you know, think for how many years about how economists created their models of how the economy was supposed to work, but sort of ignored the fact that there was a thing called environment outside that was seen as an externality. Maybe it was okay to ignore it 15, 20 years ago as a significant factor. I would argue it probably wasn't then. But today, if you ignore issues like climate change and the threats of those, if you're looking forward, you're going to end up having a compass that's misfiring. And you're seeing that with corporate balance sheets over and over again now. Things that used to be in the footnotes are now becoming center stage.
You studied wedding rituals in Tajikistan for your PhD, and I studied ward round rituals in psychiatric hospitals in London for my PhD. Both of us were studying social anthropology, but what is it about us as anthropologists and the anthropological mindset that allows us to come together regardless of what our speciality was, but yet we're able to discuss and have views on pretty much any everyday cultural phenomena?
Well, just to quickly start with the issue of rituals, rituals are very important and interesting for anthropologists, really for two reasons. Firstly, that they underscore a point that we often forget in the Western world, particularly if you are an educated elite person, which is that we don't just think and retain memory and communicate with others and express identities with words and our minds in any kind of rational sense. We do it in non-verbal, spatial, physical ways too. And rituals are often an embodied form of how we perceive the world. You know, they're not real life, and so for that reason, they're often easy to discount or ignore. But they project a sense of how we'd like to tell other people our idealized vision of real life would be. And that's often very interesting in spite of the gap with real life, or actually precisely because of the gap with real life, because it shows what people are imagining as their potential, you know, perfect existence in a way. And if you look at them, you can get a very strong sense of the kind of mental map that people have. You can often see contradictions, and you can also see gaps in what people talk about as well. So they're basically, you know, a clue you can use to help try and decode mm-hmm. a social or cultural setting. I did that in Soviet Tajikistan with marriage rituals. I did it subsequently when I became a journalist by looking at investment banking conferences, which again, big ritualistic affairs that people often take for granted, but actually reveal a lot about how people are looking at the world. And in fact, it was my decoding of the investment banking conference ritual that caused me subsequently to foresee the 2008 financial crisis.
I mean, I think that was my kind of next question about where that anthropological thinking and the ritual came into that around, you know, you're known for foreseeing that the 2008 financial crisis. And I think you described this idea of the iceberg, where everyone sees the top. I mean, but there's this enormous body of mass happening.
Well, one of the other key ideas in anthropology is that it pays to embrace a little bit of culture shock. And that if you try and immerse yourself in the life and mind of other people, you get a different vision on how the world works, which is an incredibly important principle to uphold for moral reasons, I believe. But even if you don't want to uphold it for moral reasons, which, you know, not everyone does, upholding it for reasons of fear and greed is also a good point, because if you don't understand how other people work, you're likely to trip up badly. Conversely, if you do, you can get inspiration and fresh ideas about how to live your own life. Which leads me to the second point, which is that, you know, immersing yourself briefly in the minds and lives of others or experiencing some culture shock doesn't just teach you how other people work. It also enables you to see yourself much more clearly too, and flip the lens, because there's this wonderful Chinese proverb, a fish can't see water. You know, we can't see ourselves clearly, the assumptions that shape our lives, unless we jump out of our fish bowls and flip the lid and look back. And essentially, what I did in my career is I went to Tajikistan, embraced a very different culture that seemed utterly alien to myself. And I should stress, you don't have to go to the other side of the world like Tajikistan to do that. You can just go to the end of your street or the next door department in your office, or go to a psychiatric ward in the West. You know, there are ways you can find cultural difference all over the place underneath your own nose. But you do that and then flip the lens. And so in my case, I went to Tajikistan and then came back and looked at the financial community in the City of London, looked at businesses, and then also looked at what is really the closest thing to my own tribe, which is journalism.
How did you find that, looking at journalism or in that way as the anthropologist or using the anthropological lens?
Well, the thing that really struck me when I flipped the lens on journalism above all else was that, you know, journalism, like any group, has its own creator mythology. It has its own tribes. It has its own tunnel vision and cultural map of the world, which, you know, is inevitable. And I'm not saying it's wrong to have those as a journalist, because everyone does. It's just an inevitable part of being human. But what you have to do is try to understand the weaknesses and strengths of whatever cultural map you're using. And, you know, one of the problems with journalists is that they tend to operate in structures that reflect the silos in the world around them that they're writing about. So they have banking teams, political teams, markets teams, etc., etc., because that's how Western society divides up the world. And that's often problematic because stories often hop between borders and can fall between cracks. Another problem with journalists is that they tend to, quite understandably, focus on noise, not silence, because they're very busy. And in fact, we live in a world of noise. But if you just look at noise, if you just look at what everyone's talking about and don't have time to look at silence, which is one of the things that anthropology teaches you to do, you often miss really big stories. So in the run-up to 2008, all of the noise in finance was around things like equity markets and hedge funds. The silence was a great big shadowy underbelly of finance, things like credit derivatives, which were almost entirely ignored, not because of any plot, not because the journalists were stupid, but because the whole sphere of credit derivatives was drowning in acronyms and technical language. And we're culturally, you know, predisposed in the West to downplay and ignore anything which comes wrapped up in acronyms. You know, I often used to joke the easiest way to hide something in plain sight is to basically give it jargon and an acronym. So, you know, looking at social silence as a journalist helps a lot. And the other thing is trying to think about, you know, elitism and how journalists are predisposed to assume that anyone who has command of language and control over words is inherently more credible, worthy, superior to others. That's a very embodied assumption in a lot of Western public discourse and culture. And as experiences like the rise of Donald Trump show us, that's not a view of everybody else. And journalists are fooling themselves if they project that assumption onto the rest of the world, or assume that everyone else thinks like they do.
This kind of leads on, because one of the things that really struck me about the book, there's one, I mean, I think we could have done a podcast on each chapter, but we're not. But the idea of social silence. And I feel that that chapter really was the stake in the ground for the whole of the, I mean, I was just flying, my ideas were flying all over the place. And you touched on Trump, but there was something very powerful, I thought, what you wrote about around Bigly, and this concept of Bigly versus going to watch wrestling. And maybe, I mean, maybe we could just kind of go into that a little bit, but just thinking a little bit more about this idea of social silence and how does something like Donald Trump using a word that everyone ridicules and wrestling, how does that work with social silence?
Well, I think the story about how I perceive Donald Trump is actually quite illustrative of the bigger problem, which is that the story I tell in the book starts in the autumn of 2016, when I was at the time running the news operations of the FT in America. And on the night of one of the debates, Trump used the word Bigly, and everybody in the newsroom fell about laughing, just instinctively. You know, it was literally a knee-jerk instinctive reaction. And, you know, one of the things about laughter that's very interesting from an anthropologist's point of view is that it's never neutral or trivial, because it does one of two things. It identifies or defines a social group, because you have to be in that social group implicitly to get the joke. And if you're not in the social group, then you don't get the joke. So it defines social boundaries. And secondly, it also operates by revealing all these half-stated cultural contradictions in our lives. That's why it's funny. It's about the contradictions or about the ironies and stuff, and shared cultural assumptions. And the thing that's interesting about, you know, and by the way, I should say that, you know, one of the things that AI has never managed to do, AI platforms, is to tell a good joke. AI can do almost everything else in our lives in terms of, you know, play Go, do medical analyses, design a bridge, you name it. AI machines haven't been able to tell good jokes because it's very hard for a big data set to define a social boundary and also to define all these cultural contradictions in our lives that make things funny. But the night that the Bigly word came out, it occurred to me that what you were really seeing was the tribe of the journalists, tribe of the educated elites, looking at some of the areas of social silence and laughing about it. And one of these areas was precisely this question that, or this issue about the elites assuming that because They thought that having command of language was a sign of prestige and power, that everyone else thought it was too. And the reality was that it wasn't. And other parts of America had different ways of communicating and different ways of evaluating knowledge or epistemology, to use the posh Greek word. And what that means really is that if you go to something like a wrestling match, which is incredibly popular in America, and in many ways, wrestling was the phenomena that Trump was best known for amongst most of the television watching voters. You know, the elites thought it was because of the television show The Apprentice, but actually television was arguably the better arena that they knew him from. If you go to a wrestling match, as I did during 2016, you realize that actually many of the political performance rituals and patterns and styles of communication that Trump used in the 2016 election were completely borrowed from the wrestling ring. You know, having spent years in that environment, he just transposed it onto politics. So the stage managed anger and the sense of ritualistic aggressive behavior and everything being for show and the name calling, the kind of little Mark Rubio, that kind of stuff, that all came straight from the wrestling ring.
That's incredible.
And that was important for three reasons. Firstly, it showed the power of nonverbal communication and the importance of rituals. Secondly, it showed how the educated elites, you know, who just thought everything happened in your head, couldn't understand what was going on and couldn't understand a Trump rally because they didn't realize the power of this. And thirdly, because most educated elites had never been to a wrestling match, they didn't understand what was going on at all or why Trump was connecting so much. And that shows the perils of tunnel vision in every sense, not least about the perils of being in a social tribe of your own and forgetting that there are other tribes.
It brings in the whole kind of Mary Douglas thing around pollution. I mean, Trump was polluting another world. I mean, you could flip it and say he had the empathetic button. He understood the language. You know, I mean, it's quite interesting using not the metaphor of wrestling, but actual wrestling.
Well, I think that one of the things that's great about doing a book launch and doing lots of talks like this is you learn from other people and learn what you missed in your own book and all the things you could have actually done better. And I think that if I was to write that chapter again now, I'd put in reference to Balinese cockfighting that Clifford Geertz used to try and explain why rituals and symbols command such power and can have value. And I'd also make the point about Mary Douglas and pollution, because to educated elites, having different types of epistemology, different ways of looking at the world, is almost polluting and they recoil from it.
I had my the lack of ability of listening to social science, right? But there was one big thing that really got me was when I'm working with HR departments or thinking about change and culture change, the big kind of barrier, I used to approach it as a barrier, were KPIs in an organization. So trying to get change, trying to get people on board, the KPI became the either team KPI or individual KPI became the barrier. And I would kind of almost mock it a bit like the journalists in the newsroom, thinking I was more superior than, you know. But actually then I was able to reframe it and started seeing KPIs as cultural artifacts within the organization. So they were there. I could change and negotiate them, but I wasn't going to get rid of them. And it kind of almost reminded me of, you know, Malinowski didn't go to the Trobian Islanders and say, hey, look, your cooler exchange, it's all very nice, but actually it's the trading that happens below it that's the most important thing. So get rid of your, you know. But there was that kind of thing about being able to reframe stuff and seeing it as part of culture and not outside culture, this idea of social science.
I couldn't agree more. And KPIs, you know, are ritualistic artifacts like G7 memos, in a way like balance sheets, like most of the things that we have in our lives, like ESG pledges and commitments. You know, they're not real life. They are limited and bounded and in that sense somewhat ridiculous. But they project a kind of idealized version of how people would like to operate. And they also help define communities because, you know, a KPI is only understood by the in-group and only embraced by certain people. So they're interesting. And like everything, it doesn't mean they're useless, but they can't be regarded as necessarily being the be-all and end-all or necessarily a perfect representation of reality.
The idea also of social silence, working with it in relation to meetings, everyday meetings in organisations, the rituals that are at play, the gimmicks and bringing in even psychology and transactional analysis. It's a really interesting model and concept to understand what's not being saying, how the body is used. Simon Roberts' book, for example, it's prime for that. How the architecture of space is used. It's all social science. I think Henrietta Moore used to speak about that kind of decoding text, the social space and these type of, which I found very helpful. But I'm kind of thinking about what about social science and what we're experiencing with the whole, I mean, it's a barrage of kind of narratives around hybrid working, working from home, the future of work. You know, it's becoming, the noise is amazing. I'm just wondering where social silence as an anthropologist, where that sits with all that kind of discussion and debate and...
Well, I think the most important thing people need to think about with hybrid working in offices, which I do describe at length in the book, is around the silence that actually we think we're rational beings who communicate verbally, and particularly if we work in professions, navigate the world through a kind of preset or pre-agreed set of tools like KPIs or balance sheets or economic models. You know, we all think we know what we're supposed to do at work through meetings and things. And we think we're operating, you know, like we're using, you know, a compass or a GPS system to plot a course and then follow that course in life. And in fact, I draw on the work of an anthropologist called Lucy Suchman, who wrote very powerfully in Silicon Valley about how actually we use two modes to navigate the world. One is this kind of GPS type approach. The other is something more akin to how Polynesian sailors sail without GPS, and they read the wind, they read the stars, they smell the air, they look at the currents, they kind of collectively do this as a group to absorb information to work out how and where to go. And that's also what we do in offices. We absorb information from our surroundings in all kinds of non-verbal ways to chart a course. And what's interesting is that people don't often realize the degree to which they do that until it gets taken away. And, you know, it's very interesting because when we went from real offices to Zoom, you know, there were definitely some big advantages in going on to online communication. You can talk to people all over the place. You know, you get geographical spread. You get often a more equal conversation in big groups than you might do in person where one person dominates. You tend to get much more focus often in meetings, etc. And that's all good. But like everything, it has massive drawbacks. Although small teams which have already got social capital often can move their operations online fairly easily because they know each other and trust each other, what you don't get in big Zoom calls usually are what people call serendipitous incidental information exchanges, people bumping into each other. And that's incredibly valuable in an office because it sparks all kinds of fresh ideas. I know this myself. I went into the Financial Times office, you know, in real life, in person, the other day, sat down at the office table, canteen, and had three conversations with people I hadn't spoken to for ages, and suddenly they sparked ideas. The other thing is that you can also have incredibly interesting ways of navigating the world by reading cues from people around you. And ironically, Wall Street traders have recognized for years because they could have technically taken a lot of their banking work home many years ago because Bloomberg terminals and electronic systems enabled traders to trade from home, but they haven't. They've kept building bigger and bigger trading floors, and groups like JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley are insisting everyone gets back into the office now because they realize that they actually use the sort of nonverbal sensory information, or what anthropologists call sense making, referring back to the Polynesian sailors, to navigate the world with. And that you cannot replicate through Zoom. when bankers say, you know, we want to instill our values into bankers by having them back in the office, that's partly a reference to the actual fact that you do have apprenticeships in offices. And that word tends to be used mostly for non-professional classes, but it happens in professional classes too. But even for people who are not apprentices, who are using sense-making to learn how to behave and how to think, you know, people who are already long-standing employees rely on these non-verbal clues and sense-making to get a sense of what's happening.
I think that's really helpful. And also, you're touching there on Daniel Bionza's book, but this idea, his character, you reference it around Bob and how Bob seems to spend most of his time thinking about where physical bodies are going to be positioned in on the trading floor, rather than just thinking about what's happening with the stock and shares and things like that. And I also was thinking about this, what's missing or what hasn't been discussed enough within this social silence of the future of work is around the commute. And a few years ago, I did some research, ethnographic research, and how the commute to work is framed as something that's painful, but that's actually what liminality is all about. And the cultural codes that people, about trends, about what people wear fashion-wise, about if I'm holding my body properly, all that kind of stuff, and the transition from home to work, that route, you don't necessarily get it from kitchen to office or kitchen to sitting room with Zoom.
I think going back to point I made earlier about the fact that, you know, lockdown has basically given us a type of cultural shock, which is forcing everyone to think about rituals and ceremonies and practices and boundaries in a new way. The loss of the commute definitely has made people think about what they got or did not get from the commute. I'm not saying actually it was necessarily a question of the commute being wonderful. And people might say, well, actually, the cost of the commute in terms of lost time and stress and tension, you know, is actually not worth the gain. But the gain is definitely this idea of liminality and boundaries. And when people say they're exhausted and burnt out from home working, Zoom working, that may be to a large extent because they've lost those boundaries and that sense of definition.
Yeah. You make the call also for the need to move from, or not to move from, but to introduce a new type of AI, anthropological intelligence, you call this. And I'm just wondering, what does that look like for you when you thought of that?
Well, what I'm really saying is, to go back to the compass analogy again, that AI is a very powerful tool. It can do amazing, amazing things. But like all tools, it also needs to be used with an appreciation of context. And the issue about AI, and I'm not an AI expert, but it's something where I do want to know a lot more in the future. But AI basically works off the back of, you know, massive big data sets where, you know, these brilliant computers hoover up all these data points about the world, how we're living, you know, taken from the current and near recent past, and then look for correlations and spot patterns and create prediction systems and create sort of model activities on the basis of that, you know, which is brilliant. It often delivers incredible insights, which are awesome and wonderful, and we should celebrate. It can be used in very dangerous ways, of course, as well. But that's, you know, it's like electricity. It's, you know, how you use it depends what happens to whether you attach a moral value to it or not. But, you know, AI, like any big data set, tends to suffer from, if you're not careful, it can suffer from the problem that if the context is changing, the past may not be a good guide to the future. It suffers from the problem that some of the contradictions, you know, in our lives can't be easily tracked, and correlation is not the same as causation. And big data works for the most part on correlation. Mm-hmm. It sometimes is causation, sometimes it shows you causation, but not always. And, you know, we need to look at the ethical issues around AI as well and how we're using it and the context of the people who are creating these machines and the biases they're putting it into it. So I argue that, you know, alongside AI, we need another type of AI, anthrointelligence, which is really about looking at culture, context, and consequences, what I call the three C's. And that really helps to provide a check and balance to both the perils and the promise of AI.
That's great, yeah. The final kind of area I was thinking, at the end of the book, you've written a letter to the Academy of Anthropology. And I remember when I was studying my undergraduate at London School of Economics, I had to go and have a meeting, a practical meeting, with the dean of the university to get something about a library card. And anyway, she said to me at the time, she goes, you lot on the sixth floor at LSE, where the anthropology department was at the top. So you had economics, law, and all these accountancy. But for some reason, there was this mystical anthropology at the top. And her line was, and it stuck with me, you do some great stuff on the sixth floor. I'm not quite sure what you do, but I know it's valuable. And yeah. It stuck me. And it was said with such warmth and such kind of excitement. But she had no clue what the anthropology department did. Now, this is the founding place of British social anthropology was LSE, right? You know, so you kind of think it had, you know, but she was able to say, I have no clue what you do. So in a way, your chapter there, it's kind of, or the last chapter, the letter, it's kind of not calling them out, but saying, you know, there's a real opportunity for you to branch out, to communicate to a wider world.
I wrote the letter because I, you know, have often wondered, why doesn't anthropology have more of a public voice? And one of the reasons is that the wider world tends to dismiss it as, you know, just being Indiana Jones, and they don't really understand it, which is, you know, partly the wider world's fault. But also because I think there are things about anthropology which handicap it that I think anthropologists should recognize. One is that as a discipline, because it's dedicated to the observation of other people, it tends to attract people who are prefer to listen, not talk, watch, not perform, operate on the edge of societies rather than grab center stage and the microphone, which is wonderful, makes for very interesting people, but it doesn't equip them necessarily to hustle in the modern world where it's all about hustling hard in a public way. And the fact that I spend part of my life hustling in such a public way in my current role, you know, does make me look a bit suspect to some anthropologists because it doesn't sit easily with anthropological instincts. Secondly, I think the fact that anthropologists spend such a long time analysing power structures and, you know, all the problems inherent in those leaves most of them, quite understandably, very anti-establishment and very cynical about power and money, which again is probably morally valid, but leaves them very ill-equipped to hustle for it or to try and exercise power through using the levers of institutions in an effective way. Thirdly, anthropologists can often be very tribal and very inward looking. And they, you know, can often end up just talking to each other and, you know, being very resentful of non-academics and also other departments, and that handicaps them. So in a way, or last but not least, I'd say anthropology sees life in shades of grey. Mm. It's a very discipline about subtle analysis, and, you know, that's probably the only intellectually correct type of analysis to engage in, because life is subtle shades of grey and we're full of contradictions. But the reality is that if you're trying to communicate with people, grey doesn't communicate well. You normally need punchy black and white. And many anthropologists feel that it's kind of a travesty to make those compromises and communicate in that way. I understand that and respect it. Journalism is all about making such compromises. And anthropologists may be correct when they say, well, that's actually selling out, or it's the wrong way to behave. But I happen to think that if you don't try and make some of those compromises, you're not going to get anywhere. So many journalists would argue that, in fact, working for power structures in any form is wrong, particularly if you are doing only sort of light versions of ethnography and or communicating in a way that's a bit stereotypical. I personally feel that if you're not inside a system, it's hard to change it. Mm. And I'd rather be inside the system with all the compromises this entails than outside. But I think those are all the reasons why it's been so hard, tragically hard, to get the anthropological perspective into the wider environment.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember reading Adam Cooper's book, Anthropology and Anthropologists, or it's I keep on getting the wrong way around, but it was quite apparent also there was another area of anthropology. They never seemed quite present in their own society anyway. So they, you know, the kind of historical thing of having to go somewhere far to almost find themselves, which is another thing. But do you think, I mean, there's something that the academy should be doing now? Is there a space for them to move into, for anthropologists to move into? Because what I'm finding is that business schools, if anything, are the areas, the academic areas that are taking anthropological theory and making it into models. So Cambridge Judge Business School is fantastic stuff with Jennifer Howard Grenfell on liminality and organizational change. But these are models. They're not just theories, and there you go. It's actually trying to move grey into black and white.
I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Well, the answer is that, you know, anthropology is cropping up all over the place, but without the word anthropology, because it's got such a brand problem. So it's either called management studies or USX or all kinds of different kind of words. And that's a pity, because anthropology should be grabbing it and, you know, proclaiming it loudly. The fact that the group Ethnographic Praxis and Context, EPIC, had to call itself EPIC and create itself as an organisation that's apart from the American Anthropological Association speaks volumes about the branding problem and the tribal problem inside the academic discipline. I'm not saying that to criticise individual anthropologists. There are many great anthropologists, but more just to say there are structural problems today. If I was designing a manifesto for change in the academic discipline, I would do several things. One is to encourage anthropologists to get out and hustle, encourage them to recognise the compromises needed to communicate well, and to do that. You know, and if they don't want to do it through public forums, contribute to the conversation. It's a brilliant platform which takes academic writing and tries to popularise it. Contribute to Sapiens. Do everything you can to get the wider message out into the world. I would encourage anthropologists to recognise that sometimes amazing work is done outside academic circles and that they should be collaborating with them. And that doesn't mean they should be not recognising the value of academic anthropology, but they should also be recognising that sometimes doing shorter studies outside the anthropology world, even if you have to compromise and just do a study for like a month or a network or something like that, is still valuable. And then encourage academics or encourage non-academics to draw on the body of academic anthropology to supplement their short studies. That, again, requires writing in English and getting the word out about what's out there. I would encourage anthropologists to work with other disciplines and actively try and blend social and computer science. You know, data analysis is brilliant, but it's limited. But we need to recognise they're both very, very useful. I'd encourage anthropologists to go out and work with economists and lawyers and all these different fields to the max to try and create these new forms of analysis. And then lastly, you know, don't discount working for companies or governments, because although anthropologists often think that that's sort of a sellout, and it can be sometimes, and you have to keep your ethical radar switched on, it can also be another way of not just conducting, you know, informal field work, but also trying to, you know, look at the world afresh and get the message out.
Yeah. Well, Gillian, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you for your time. I do ask all my guests this ending, this kind of bookend question. I'm going to symbolically give you or hand you over Zoom here from South London to Long Island, the anthropologist's notebook for you to take away for a year to go and study any organization, corporation, brand or industry that you want to. And it'd be great to understand where you're going to take it and why.
Well, my first response was to imagine the media world, because I think I'd love to spend a year quietly just studying media without doing media. But that's, you know, just so I can learn how to do it better. But actually, I think what I'd really like to do is go and study AI production and AI workers, because I don't fully understand how AI works. I haven't been trained in that. I've got a rough idea, but I don't completely understand the sphere. And I very badly want to. And I think the people who can actually combine a deep, in-depth knowledge of AI with an anthro-intelligence as well will have a skill set that will be very valuable for the future.
Yeah. Well, Gillian, thank you so much for being on Decoding Culture.
Thank you. Great. And thanks for all the great work you're doing with the podcast.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I hope that you see that without Anthrovision or a new AI, anthropological intelligence, we will not truly understand how we as social animals make sense of our world. Empathy, in its true sense, will be key. If you're interested more in how anthropology adds value to business and especially organizational culture, I'm running my 5-week training program for the third time in partnership with Epic. It is called Leveraging Organizational Culture for Impact and starts in September 2021. I'll put details of the course content in the show notes and dates will be confirmed soon. Please do subscribe to the podcast feed and please feel free to give the podcast a rating on iTunes. To keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business and anthropology, also sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. And again, the link will also be in the show notes. See you next time.